Hello, welcome to Profiles. I'm Moya Andrews, and today we have the opportunity to meet an individual who plays an important part in our campus community. She is Karen Hansen, the Provost of the Bloomington campus. Karen, welcome to Profiles. It's our pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you, Moya.
After a few months now as Provost on the Bloomington campus, can you explain to our listeners what the job actually entails?
Well, the job is interestingly different every day, but in structural terms, the provost is the academic chief officer of the campus, so that all the academic schools report to the provost and the academic administrative units as well that support the mission of this campus. The provost is someone who consults with the deans and the faculty and the professional staff and the students to realize the best mission for the Bloomington campus and to try to set a budget that will follow those priorities.
Well, it sounds like quite a lot of work. What has surprised you most as you've settled into the job?
I don't know that I've settled into the job. I'm still busy as can be every day. And one of the things that I suppose has been a little bit surprising to me is that there really is so much to learn about the university. That may sound naive, but I've been here a very long time. I've been on this campus for 31 years and actively involved in a range of activities on the campus, but there's so many more new things to learn. One of the things, of course, is that a campus constantly renews itself with new students, new faculty, and new staff, and the frontiers of knowledge keep being pushed in new directions in a variety of ways. And so there's always something for each of us to learn every day, but in this job where the purview is quite large, it's been quite exhilarating.
But as an experienced faculty member and administrator, you have a wonderful track record on this campus, and your prior experiences are undoubtedly very helpful to you in this new position. Can you talk a little bit about how your past has informed your vision for your new office?
Well, I think it is useful to me to have been here for a long time and to have been very active as a teacher and as a researcher and as someone who's committed to faculty governance. One of the virtues of a life in a university, I think, for any of us is that it offers a lot of opportunities for growth throughout the decades. You can take on new research projects. You're always meeting new students who themselves bring a lot to every class you teach. Even if it's the same class, it's never the same. I was always interested in understanding the structure of organizations with which I was associated. And that held me in good stead at Indiana University because I became actively involved in committee work and faculty governance and so on fairly early on. That's helped me know about schools that are not my own. It's been useful to be in the Honors College, which depends on the cooperation of all of the schools on campus, and to see a little bit about how we can serve each other in forwarding certain goals that we might have in common, but which one unit might be charged to tend to especially. So the sort of background I've had, which has been in some ways consistently as a faculty member in philosophy, has also been helped, I think, by other ways in which I've tried to embed myself in the life of the university.
And you certainly have done that. I would imagine there are very few committees on this campus that you have not served on at some time.
That may be true, and I think I probably served with you on many of them.
That's true. I can imagine that over the years you have learned a lot about how to be a good committee member. Tell us about the size of your office now. Do you have a large staff, and are some of them people that were there before?
It's not a large staff. We're trying to stay as lean as possible as we because you know the things that go into building that staff might also go into building academic programs. But we are kind of building a staff a bit from the ground up. Some of the budgetary people remain, but many of the other staff members who were in the interim provost's office have, of course, moved to the president's office. So we had been starting from scratch in building up that side of the provost's staff. We have some wonderful folks in there right now, though, who are doing a terrific job.
Well, that's important. I know that the faculty and staff are, in many ways, the heart of the campus. And I know that all of them are eager to cooperate with you in this wonderful new undertaking. How much actual time do you have to spend with entities that aren't faculty, student, or staff related, such as the trustees, the foundation, and the chancellors at the other campuses? Mm-hmm. I mean, you have so many different relationships, both outside the campus and inside the campus. So are the outside ones very time-consuming?
Well, one thing I think is important to underscore that there are all of those other relations, and you're right, there are many, because I also have a system-wide responsibility, have to be seen as related to the faculty and staff of the campus. The faculty and staff and students are the heart of the campus. The research and the educational missions are the core of what we do. So any of these other interchanges with the outside community, with the trustees, with the chancellors of the other campuses are also in some ways focused on the core missions. There is a monthly meeting with the heads of the other campuses, and of course the trustees meet a few times a year, about four times a year, and we stay in touch on other matters throughout the year. But all of what we do has to be driven by our concern for education and research, and hence for the affairs of the students and the faculty, and then of course, the professional staff and the clerical staff and the service staff are also supporting these missions as well. So there's virtually nothing I do that isn't centered around the academic mission.
Undergraduate education, I know, has always been a passion of yours. You've always been very involved in undergraduate education. And this is a time when undergraduate education is, there are many issues in that area that are being addressed on the campus, such as the general education requirement, enrollment issues. Mm-hmm. So talk to me a little bit about your vision and what are the priorities in terms of undergraduate education at the moment.
As you know, the quality of the undergraduate population on the Bloomington campus is increasing by the measures that are usually used. What we really want to make sure is that the quality of the education these students receive is increasing, and that we're getting students who are motivated enough to take full advantage of what we offer. We are currently scrutinizing the undergraduate curricula in all the schools, in part because the new general education requirements are coming on board. So each unit is looking at what it might offer as part of general education. Though the new general education requirements will be in effect in 2011, it's taking a lot of preparation. There's a lot of work going on right now in order to get those requirements in place and operative by that time. In addition, some of the other strategic directions for the campus, those involved with internationalization, for example, are playing a role in how people are thinking of the courses they're offering and the kinds of ancillary experiences in addition to courses that might conduce to the achievement of that goal. We are actively recruiting the best and the brightest of Indiana students, and word is getting out about the extent to which this is a destination school for the world. And so what we want to make sure is that we advise these students properly. Our professional advisors are extraordinarily important because this is a rich and complex campus. All of the things that make this a wonderful place for students to go to school are also things that can make it a challenge for students to find all the opportunities, because it's big, it's complex, and it's full of opportunities. We want to make sure that students are living in the appropriate environment to take full advantage of their education, so that they are serious about their work here. We want them to have fun. This is a terrific town. It's a terrific campus. There are lots and lots of things to do that don't involve classes. But we want to do a little better, I think, in connecting the residents' life and the academic mission of the university. I think everybody's on board for that as a project. There are a variety of ways in which the experience can be enhanced, I think, for the 4, sometimes 5 year students spend as undergraduates here. And we have terrific classes. We have a terrific staff dedicated to advising and to residence life. But there are ways in which we can work, I think, to integrate better some of the functions that we already are attentive to.
Well, that in itself is a lot of work. But you also have a whole list of other directives that the president has indicated you'll be spearheading across campus. So can you review these for our listeners?
Mm-hmm. Well, as we mentioned, in addition to education and education for graduate students and professional students as well as undergraduates, research is our other major mission, of course. And we're interested in seeing to it that IU attracts its share of the research dollars that are available competitively. So we want to encourage faculty to put forward the best proposals they can and to look for the best opportunities for research that they can. We want to make sure that all of the elements of the campus that have been so important to its standing over the course of IU, its standing in the arts and humanities and the social sciences, are remembered during a time at which the initiative in the life sciences is also so important. Mm. The latter is, of course, important for most major research universities, and it's important for IU, and we have a lot of strengths in this area, and we're forging more and more cooperative relations across campuses in connection with the Life Sciences Initiative. But it's important that we don't forget that Bloomington has some core strengths in some other areas as well, and there are infrastructure needs in those areas. We have wonderful museums, wonderful orchestras, wonderful collections. We need to make sure that we house our collections properly. We need to make sure that we have performing spaces for all the wonderful students that we attract. There are some tasks to accomplish in this area.
I think the faculty and staff feel very pleased that someone with your long track record in the arts and humanities is in your role, because it's all such a question of balance, isn't it? To yes. balance the old traditions and the areas that have earned us our Research One designation as mm-hmm. a university with the new topics and issues that are emerging that we have to keep a pace with.
Mm-hmm.
So balance is such a hard thing to attain.
Yes, and certainly it is in a complex organization such as this. It is for any university. But we do have to remain mindful of the terrific faculty, the terrific collections, the terrific traditions that we have on this campus in some of these areas, and not to lose any of those strengths. Those fields change as well, and they need the bases for performance, for exhibition, for research materials. I mean, we have, this is obvious in some cases, these are common goods. The library is a common good for the entire campus, and everyone wants to support it. The needs of the libraries change over time as our approaches to research change over time. But we need to be attentive to all of these things, to the need for big equipment for the life sciences, but also the need for performing spaces and for conservation of our collections and ways of making available some of the rich treasures this campus holds.
And we would like, I'm sure, to try to get more students to avail themselves of the collections and mm-hmm. the performances while they're here. Mm-hmm. That's always so hard, to try to attract students is to make the most of their time here on this campus.
Absolutely. That is really important. It's another part of the education they get outside of classes. And I'm working with some of the faculty and staff on some of those issues to think about ways of building that into student life in a way that hit them with a over the head with the idea that they must do this, but invites students in to see the ways in which their lives can be enriched by learning about these things at this juncture when they have the time and things are available.
That's right. Herman Wells always said you should hire the best faculty and give them what they need so they can do their best work. And I know you agree with that. But how can the provost translate this into reality when dollars are so short and have to be spread so far?
I do agree with that. But you're absolutely right. The give them what they need directive is very difficult in days when some of the needs that allow research and teaching to go on are terribly expensive. And there is always going to be a limited pie to be divided among a number of worthy enterprises. I think the way in which we have to proceed, though, is through consultation and deliberation among the parties to the research and teaching enterprise. It's important that the provost consult with the deans and the deans with the faculty and the that the priorities are set in a consultative manner. Everyone may not be absolutely happy with what happens one year, but they will understand why the decisions were made as they are, and that enterprises which are crucial to the work of the campus will find support one way or another.
Well, that's good to hear. Nationally, the number of non-tenurable faculty versus tenurable or tenured faculty is growing. In some areas, such as the West Coast, of course, it's growing very fast. But it's also growing at IU, the non-tenurable faculty. And, of course, some of these faculty are crucial to our mission. They do very important and very valuable work. But some experts suggest that a critical ratio of both categories has to be arrived at, especially in a Research One institution, if the institution is to keep its ranking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know the Faculty Council are working on this issue, and it's hard to know how to set caps or how to arrive at ratios because each school is so different, mm-hmm. and the teaching and research missions are different in each school. And I wonder whether you view this as something where policies should be set as campus-wide policies or as school-wide policies, or whether you have any other ideas about how to keep the balance. Again, mm-hmm. it's another question of balance between both types of faculty and the important work they do.
You're absolutely right that this is an important issue in higher education as a whole now, and it's certainly an important issue for this campus as well. The campus has done some good things in recent years in order to ensure that non-tenure track faculty have career ladders, that they have and feel a stake in matters beyond teaching the particular classes that they do, that they have a variety of pathways to participate more fully in the life of the university. That's one of the things that's so crucial about this, that our traditions are those that involve faculty governance and faculty controlling various elements of the university that are at the heart of the university. It's curriculum and its research mission. There are problems if we end up with a kind of bifurcated faculty where some are just doing research and are out of touch with the teaching mission, and some are just teaching and are not controlling matters like the curriculum. And this is what is a problem for higher education. Again, it's been one of the responses to more limited resources, and it's a worrisome trend, I think, for many institutions. You're right that our situation is also complicated by our having so many schools with different profiles and slightly different missions on the campus. So while I think there should be some campus policies, and indeed there are, it's also true that we have to understand the ways in which these policies impact the schools differently and consult with the schools to see what it might mean. But I think all of us have to keep at the forefront the idea that having an integrated sense of the enterprise is important for the core of the campus, that the faculty have to understand that the missions of research and education are intertwined, and there are certain arrangements of job duties which don't conduce to that and some which do, and we've got to keep our eye on the ball there.
That's true. Well, this might be a good time to take a break and play some music. Have you brought a selection for us?
Yes, I brought a few selections. The first is a spiritual sung in concert live by Catherine Battle and Jesse Norman, something that at various difficult moments of life I have found quite soothing. I think I'm not alone in this. This was something that I understand has been was much requested after 9/11. It's There's a Balm in Gilead.
I'm Moya Andrews, and I'm speaking with Karen Hansen, the provost of the Bloomington campus of Indiana University. Karen, can you let us know a little bit about your background? I think you grew up in Minnesota.
Yes, I grew up in Minnesota. My father worked at the University of Minnesota as a professor of animal science. He grew up on a farm in western Minnesota, one of nine children, and all of the boys in the family went away to school, got degrees in things related to farming, agronomy, plant pathology, animal science. I think the idea of going to school and studying philosophy would have seemed like the idea of going to Mars. But I grew up in basically an academic environment and had the freedom then to think about studying math and philosophy and other apparently less useful subjects. I would make an argument that they're just as crucial to life, but that's for another day.
So you were a math major as an undergraduate?
Yes.
And then?
Philosophy and math.
Philosophy and math.
Yes.
Well, the math will come in handy with your budgets.
I hope so.
And then where did you go? Where did you get your bachelor's degree?
I went to the University of Minnesota as an undergraduate and then did my graduate work at Harvard.
So your master's and your PhD at
yes.
Harvard. And that was when you really
specialized in philosophy.
Specialized in philosophy.
Yes.
And did you always want to be an academic like your father, or at some point did you have a sudden epiphany?
Truth to tell, neither one exactly. I really did not know what I wanted to do for a very long time. I almost have to say I wasn't entirely certain even when I came to IU. That's partly why I double majored. I thought about going in a variety of directions. And it didn't even occur to me to be an academic until one of those career days in high school when that was suggested by a teacher who I think was simply going on the idea that that was the family shop. And it was truly the first time I actually thought, that's a possibility. But I don't think I really settled on it until I actually settled into the job and discovered that it really did have all of the terrific features that I have reason to be grateful for. I mean, it allows you to keep learning. It allows you to look into new areas. Allows you to keep growing. It's been wonderful, and I'm glad I should say I drifted into it instead of decided on it. But that sounds a little indecisive.
Probably one of the reasons why you connect so well with other faculty is that you're so used to having them around. You have one at home as a husband.
That's true. My husband is also a philosopher. Pity now, our children.
When did you meet your husband? Was it at IU or before that?
It was before that. He was proctoring. He was a graduate student where I was an undergraduate, and he was proctoring an exam I was taking. On Immanuel Kant, actually.
Well, that's an interesting way to meet. You didn't need the internet.
That's
you
right.
And I both came to IU in the 1970s, and there were not as many women faculty here then. Remember how we seemed to know all of the women by name in those days?
That was terrific. I mean, in some ways it wasn't terrific because there weren't very many women, but it was partly that group of women that I think changed the landscape of the university a bit in the ensuing decades. And one of the things that really was terrific, besides getting to know a really wonderful network around the campus, was that we all worked together for common goals. And that's one of the things that I wouldn't like to see it duplicated, but out of a sense that people are underrepresented minorities. But it is important for people to get out of their own smaller circles, to connect with people in other ways, for working for common goals for the university. And it does develop a wonderful and sustaining sense of community, I think.
That lasts a long time.
Yes.
Now, how do you think it's changed for women on campus, and also for minorities on campus, from all those years ago in the 70s?
We still have a long way to go, really, on both fronts, particularly with underrepresented minorities. Women are more and more frequently seen in the professorial and professional and service staff ranks, but they are still not proportionally represented at the full professor rank or in the administration. So we have a way to go with that. We have a way to go with recruitment and the hiring of underrepresented racial and ethnic groups on campus, too. I think in a variety of ways there is a clear sense that there's a commitment on the part of the campus and that many people recognize this is good for the university. So in that sense, I'm hopeful, but we do have work to do.
As well as having a dual career marriage, and you have two daughters, so you know firsthand the challenges involved in finding a balance between work and family. What advice do you have for others, men and women, who face this challenge of trying to balance a very pressing academic career with family affairs?
I'm not sure I have advice to give on that. I muddle through as best I can. Everything is pressing. Everything is always pressing from all directions. I mean, that's one of the things I suppose that you're having a family teaches you, that you are not the center of the universe yourself, and that matters are always in need of attention in a variety of directions. I mean, that's something you might learn in a variety of other ways, but you certainly learn it in a family. And I think, you know, in a way, it underscores something that is just existentially true. There is always more work to be done than there is time to do it. And you just have to do the best you can and size up each situation to see which is the most pressing need at the moment.
Well, it's that balance again. Mm-hmm. There's always a question of balance. And I think no matter how old you get, this is always the problem that is most hard to solve. Time is such a precious commodity for all of us. How do you find time to rejuvenate while you're balancing all these pressing needs?
I don't know. I don't have a set plan to, you know, a certain, you know, period of the day where I make sure that I get myself in a position to rejuvenate. I do try to exercise if I can. I do listen to music when I can, but I've got to admit there's a lot of multitasking going on all the time. While I'm exercising, I'm reading. While I'm listening to music, I'm doing something else, like cooking dinner or something. The days are exceptionally busy, but on the other hand, I think that's rejuvenating too. Finding new challenges is something that can get your energy up.
And I suppose, too, now you have a lot more after-hours commitments.
Yes.
Trips away to trustees' meetings, evening meetings.
Yes.
So I suppose more and more your husband and children have to learn to be independent, which in itself may be a good
thing. That's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing. I've during the course of the time that my children have been on this earth, I've of course gone out of town. I mean, I had an active research career, and that involves some travel. It's true there are more ceremonial functions now and things that run through the dinner hour and so on, and I hope they're learning to cook as well.
It would be a good thing if they did.
That's right.
What was the last non-work-related book that you read?
Elizabeth Costello by John Coetzee. Right now I'm reading The Woman at the Washington Zoo by Marjorie Williams, partly because it has little sections that are self-contained, which is something you tend to do when you have these short periods of time. But the first is a novel by wonderful South African writer, I guess now a native of Australia. I mean, now a citizen of Australia, Nobel Prize winner. I mean, the first thing of Coetzee's I read was Disgrace. He has also visited the Bloomington campus and gave a wonderful reading. The Woman at the Washington Zoo is by a writer who worked for the Washington Post and also wrote for Vanity Fair. It includes a number of political profiles. Again, a very lively writer, very perceptive on both the political and, I think, the emotional fronts.
What's your idea of an ideal vocation?
That's probably changed over the years. I think I would have been much more inclined a few years ago to have said something that involves travel to a place I've never been and involves learning a lot about the place I've never been and immersing myself in the culture. That's still true. But at this point, I'm also interested in the sort of vacations that involve lying on a beach and reading a book. So either one would do at this point.
I believe you took the girls to South Africa for their first visit out of the country.
Yes, they've done some international travel with us now as we've been, you know, doing, you know, reading a paper elsewhere, working at being asked to participate in a colloquium or something and the very first time that I accepted an invitation of that sort after the girls were born, it was when I thought they were old enough to travel, and they were eight, and so their first destination was Africa, and you know they had no problems with jet lag. They had a terrific time. They've since gone to a lot of continents with us, and I think it's been good for them. It's been good for us to see things through their eyes as well. So it's been, I think they've been lucky to have parents who have those opportunities, and I think we've been lucky to have them with us.
How old are they now?
They're now 17.
Soon they will be leaving home, and that will
maybe
be... And we'll think about your next music selection. What have you brought?
The next piece is something that is I like myself, and it's also important to me because it was from a show that we saw with the girls on their first trip abroad, and it was from a show in Johannesburg, a wonderful piece of theater called Zulu, and this is from the overture.
That was a wonderful excerpt from the CD, The Zulu, chosen by our guest, Karen Hansen, the provost of the Bloomington campus. Karen, we read a lot about how to become an effective leader. There's probably been more books written about that than on many topics. Have you had mentors or experiences that have shaped your leadership style?
I'm sure I have. I mean, part of what we talked about earlier, the way in which young faculty coming onto this campus worked together and worked with more experienced faculty in a variety of governance roles, helped shape my sense of how to be effective. I mean, you can observe, you can be an apprentice for a while, and then and then you want to do what you can to reach the goals that you have. I'm grateful to the mentors I had in graduate school. I'm grateful to the people from whom I learned here on campus. I mean, mentors come in lots of forms. I mean, I think when we think of that, we often think of some older person who is self-consciously offering that kind of assistance. But really, you can find mentors in a variety of ways by observing what's effective, and they can be people in a variety of roles.
Well, you were very involved in the faculty council when you were younger, and now you're very involved again. But I suppose on this campus, there may be a certain type of leadership style that is related to the fact that this is a faculty governance campus. Do you think that's so?
Yes, I think that it is particularly important. It's on this campus, but it really is a matter of a respect for the kind of mission that higher education and research universities have that really transcends this campus. I mean, leadership has to be consultative because the expertise is widely disseminated. The aims are in some ways common, but in many ways there are pursuits that people have that are best understood from the inside and that demand an enormous amount of expertise. None of us has all of that expertise, and that's why a kind of model of consultation and deliberation with others is crucial to I think, leadership on this campus and probably throughout the community of research universities.
That's probably so. Now, you've evolved as a leader, first as department chair, and then as dean, and now as provost. Have you had to adjust your leadership style in these different contexts?
I don't know if the style is adjusted. Those are interesting posts along the way, because a department chair, at least at this university, is someone who has to work in a very self-consciously democratic fashion. I mean, departments work or not as all the faculty buy into the purposes of the department. And you learn a lot of negotiating skills, and you learn a lot of things about your colleagues that you might not have known before you took on that administrative role. Deans have a slightly different purview, and of course the honors dean is a slightly idiosyncratic position because the honors college has only a handful of its own faculty and mostly works with the faculty who really report to other deans. So you particularly learn how to work persuasively but without much besides persuasion to effect results. The role as provost, I think, in many ways calls on some of the same skills you might develop in those ways. Again, I think it's important that leadership on this campus be consultative, that it take guidance from the expertise that's widely distributed.
Well, that's probably true. I've also heard a theory that parenting is the best training for administration. Parents learn that they have to hear each child's side in a conflict. They have to be equitable in the distribution of attention, candy, and toys. Do you think there are any lessons here that apply to administration?
I suppose that's true. But I think that what we're talking about there are various forms of distributive justice, which probably ring differently in the family than they do on the campus. But everybody demands justice. And some of the things that you mentioned are probably just principles of good sense, listening to all sides, being equitable. Those are probably things that are important on the family and in the wider community and well on the campus as well.
I suppose in a family, the bad child often gets the lion's share of the attention. And this may also happen sometimes on campus. It's hard to sometimes be sure that we pay attention to those that are quietly doing their work and not claiming a lot of attention or time from the administration.
That can be true. It's something to guard against, really. I mean, one has to enter that reminder to oneself from time to time.
That's true. Time management. You said a little while ago that you muddle through, mm-hmm. and I think we all feel that way because there are so many pressures. But have you made any efforts to improve your time management skills that the rest of us could learn from?
Well, I do think that is a difficult thing to learn, and I think it's particularly difficult if one has the attitude that I just avowed, that it is important to listen to people. But there are only so many hours in the day, and I think it is important to make sure that you're allocating the time wisely, and that means not allowing some meetings to go on longer than they need to go on. So being a little stiffer in my resolve to make sure that I allocate my time wisely, and as opposed to letting the time be used up by whichever wheel is squeakiest, that is an important thing to learn.
And it's so hard to do, though. Mm-hmm. You must have so many facets to your job, and then that, of course, means that you have to delegate a lot. And delegation's another one of those things, like time management. How do you know when to do it? I suppose it's a matter of seeing the overall big picture and where each thing slots in.
But it is particularly difficult, especially at the beginning of a job, when you are trying to get the lay of the land, to know which of the matters requires your attention and which you can delegate. And that's something that, you know, a few months in is still something I think I'm learning, because I do think it's important to know the full the full scope of the job, how many things are affected by the decisions that are made in the provost's office. So right now, I think I am scrambling, and if for a while it's a 36-hour-a-day job, that's okay.
Well, that's a very honest answer, and I think that's what we've always had from you, honest answers at every stage in your career, and so we shouldn't be surprised that that's what we're getting now. What kind of daily schedule do you have? I know I'm focusing on the nuts and bolts a little bit here, but is every day different?
Yes, so far. I mean, there may come to be some giant rhythms here, but in a few months, those haven't exactly emerged. There are part of what makes every day different so far is that I've been making an effort to make sure that I get out to each of the schools for some initial overviews of what's been happening in those schools. There are the things that come along with some regularity, the meetings that the relevant constituencies, the dean's meetings, the meetings of the president's cabinets, the meetings of the chancellors, the sorts of things that we talked about before. Those things do fall at regular times, but other things that are connected with getting the lay of the land, those remain different every day. And as you noted, there are a number of initiatives that are rolling along right now that require quite a bit of attention. And I assume when we finish those jobs, there will be new challenges. And so I don't expect it ever to become a repetitive pattern.
Well, that's good, because we all went into this kind of work because we liked variety, I'm sure. But accessibility, mm-hmm. there's another one of those catchwords. Mm-hmm. How accessible are you, and how accessible should you be as our chief academic officer?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious I'm very accessible, because I've been here a long time, and people, when I was named to the post, were in touch with me immediately from a variety of quarters. I mean, people know where to find me, both electronically, and they know where to find me in my office. And I do see lots of students there. I do see lots of faculty. I do see lots of deans. I think people feel comfortable coming in to see me about a variety of issues. They're certainly welcome to.
I think that the faculty and students appreciate this in a chief academic officer. Mm. And I know that this will be something that people will take you up on, this invitation to come and see them. Do people on campus treat you any differently now that you're a provost?
Not so that I notice. I think people have known me too long to think of me differently now that I'm a provost. I mean, they have certain expectations about how they want the job done in an appropriate way, and I think that's right. But I don't think they think of me personally differently.
And what do you think would be the ideal amount of time for a provost to stay in a role like this? Or how long could anyone possibly do this?
I don't know. And I probably won't plumb the depths of this because of my own age and stage of my career. But you want to stay long enough to get some things done. And you don't want to stay past the time when you might be energetically getting things done. So it probably depends on the person. It depends upon the challenges that particular institution is facing.
Well, we're very glad to have you in this role, and it's been wonderful to talk to you today. And that brings us to the conclusion of this interview. We will use one more music selection. Can you tell us what it is?
Thank you, Moya. This has been a pleasure. I picked for the last selection Pelléas and Mélisande by Fauré. One of the reasons was that this was the first thing I heard on the radio as I rolled into Bloomington 31 years ago, going to set up an apartment, not sure whether or not I would stay in this location or not. It was my first teaching job out of graduate school. And this was the theme song from one of the morning programs on WFIU. And when I met my apartment mate in the building we were going to live in, they talked about the wonderful time they had had the night before hearing the Beaux-Arts Trio and reminded me of what a special place this was. This really, I think, made an impression on me, and indeed that impression has lasted.
Well, what a wonderful way to end our interview. Our guest today was Karen Hansen, the provost of the Bloomington campus. Karen, thank you for spending time with us today and for sharing your thoughts and your philosophies with our WFIU audience. I'm Moya Andrews, and thanks for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in November of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.